about the future, but also to hear your answer about the offer I made you a week ago. That should have been more than enough time for you to read the terms and conditions of minionship. I'm sure you have found that they're quite reasonable."
Father Philip, the leader of the cult of the many-tentacled, shook a slithery appendage in Ed's direction.
"What's not reasonable is the amount of pages in those terms, Lord Wright. My church lacks the funds to hire a clerk to make sense of them for us."
Alfred could see that most of the people around the table seemed suddenly uncomfortable. Accepting minionship to a dungeon lord was a greater commitment than, say, paying taxes and tribute to a Heligian conqueror. The thief suspected that more than a few nobles and well-to-do merchants would have liked nothing more than to tell Wright to take his terms and stuff them. Of course, they couldn't insult the dungeon lord whose jamming towers protected Undercity and its surroundings from the militant church. Alfred wasn't a diviner, but he was sure many of his peers were wondering just how true the rumors were regarding Lord Wright's overwatch of the city. The fact that some people at that very table hadn't yet tried to depose the dungeon lord spoke volumes about their unwillingness to meet in secret to conspire against him. And there was also the vampire to consider. No one wanted to end up like the Acathunians, hunted like rats in their own city, wondering if the movement in the corner was a cockroach or actually Wright's spy.
"Your terms are most charitable, your badness,"
Grandmaster Brewer said, putting all his charm ranks to use.
"But given the volatile situation of the city, I'm sure you understand we need more time before jumping to such an important..."
18 months,
Wright said, speaking over him. The brewer began stammering, then shut up for a second.
"Beg your pardon?"
he managed, visibly confused.
"That's the window of time Heligies needs to gather its armies and send them here to reinforce the navy," the dungeon lord said calmly. "In other words, in 18 months' time, Staravos will suffer a second invasion."
Whispers spread through the table.
"A year and a half? That's impossible!"
a nobleman exclaimed. His name was Theodore. His father had fought against Heligies during the war, which gave Theodore great standing among his noble peers, as long as no inquisitors were nearby.
"Heligies has relied on heroes to do its dirty work for a generation. It can't just summon a new invading army out of thin air. They need to train their infantry, gather the commoners, forge weapons and armor, gather provisions, and deal with their noblemen. We're talking 3 years at least."
Chronicler Alder raised a hand.
"People, our best diviners and tacticians both confirmed it. When an entire country hates your guts and wants to travel half the world for a chance to kill you, they'll make it happen."
Alfred turned to the necromancer seated next to him.
"I hear Plekth has rather nice weather, and their new adventurers' guild is hiring. Maybe it's time for a change of locale, eh? See the world? Most adventurers aren't on friendly terms with necromancers,"
the pale man said.
"Well, I can put in a good word for you,"
Alfred said with a wink. Around them, people were losing their nerve. Alfred understood why. They were like rats in a bucket that was slowly filling with water. They couldn't abandon the city. The Inquisition still controlled the rest of Staravos, and the sea was under the dominion of the Heligian Navy. That left only the wetlands to the south, but that was as sure as death for a merchant.
"Can you stop them?"
someone asked the dungeon lord. Alfred caught a glimpse of a smile dance across Wright's face. Lavina, head witch of the haunt, laughed in the face of the woman that had asked the question.
"First you try to wriggle out of a minionship, and now you're asking us to save you? Again?"
"But you must!"
someone else exclaimed. Wright stood up, spreading the scroll he had been holding along the table. It was a map of Staravos. Alfred and the others stood as well, as to take a better look. The most important cities were marked on the map. Galtia, Basilia, Salda, Kuranis, Matina, Constantina, Raventa. Along with trading routes, forts, rivers, mines, roads, mountain ranges, lakes, and so on. It was the sort of map a general may use to plan a campaign.
"And I will," the dungeon lord said.
but the haunt can't do it on its own. He placed a finger over Constantina. It was the southernmost holding of Staravos, which was how it originally got its nickname of Undercity, and traced a path to the northeast, past Raventa and Matina, and then farther beyond Galtia's mountaintops until stopping at the capital itself.
As we speak, the militant church is leading a campaign based in Galtia to retake the lost territories around our city, Lord Wright said. The Haunt's towers deny access to their heroes, so they must rely on Inquisitors and their militant soldiers to destroy the towers and allow the heroes to move in. Meanwhile, we protect the towers by creating dungeons around them, manned with mercenaries from the Netherworld hired with the taxes that the fine people in this room kindly share with us.
He spoke smoothly, as if he'd rehearsed this meeting beforehand. Chronicler Alder seemed proud of himself, judging from the way he relaxed in his seat.
Day by day, the militant church summons more forces and high-level inquisitors into Galtia. We've managed to keep the advantage by connecting every dungeon to our railway network, so we can move our forces back if they face unsurmountable odds. Nothing in our arsenal, though, is going to be enough once the militant army arrives. An invading force meant to challenge a kingdom will crush a city's worth of resources like it was nothing.
He stared at the grim visages in the room.
Unless...
Which Lavina pointed out.
Unless, Lord Wright agreed, we welcome them with an army of our own, and a kingdom's resources at our back.
He tapped on Galtia's position on the map.
The militant church is not attacking our dungeons in order to retake Undercity. That's what the army is meant for. The Inquisitors scouring the countryside are trying to keep the haunt from spreading throughout the whole country. Well, sadly for them, that's exactly what I intend to do. Staravos has suffered under Heligian rule for long enough, I say. With our combined might, we'll make a stand against the Heligian host. We'll break them so they learn to never bother us again.
Silence spread through the room as, outside, Kamkana and its sister Ulira replaced the warm sunlight with their silvery blue glow.
That's a mighty speech! Alfred said cheerfully. Don't take this the wrong way, Lord Wright, but don't you need an army of your own to take a city? Some of our brethren are doing quite well under Heligian occupation. They're sure to be rather reticent to see the nobleness of your plan. They may need the kind of persuasion that a few thousand horned spiders and a Kuftar clan won't be enough to deliver.
Wright nodded.
Thank you, Master Alfred. You're right. That's the reason why I desire all of you to accept my offer of minionship. In the Netherworld lies an abandoned facility that's capable of creating monsters, weapons, and spells for entire hosts of dungeon lords. This colossal complex, built during the old days, before Bastivar and Everbleed, has the resources to raise an army of monsters for me to face the Inquisition.
An eldritch glint shone in the pupils of his evil eye.
In the upcoming months, I'll enter a contest against the other dungeon lords for possession of this facility. I intend to win this endeavor, but in the meantime, I must leave Undercity in your hands. The only way I can trust you to protect this city without you betraying me and one another is if you join the ranks of the Haunt as my minions.
So, it's real,
Alfred whispered to himself, barely listening to the last part of the dungeon lord's words.
St. Clair and Tillman, the factory of nightmares. I thought it was only a legend to entertain children before bed.
He had been one such child, a long time ago. And this man here, not a gray hair on his head, talked about becoming the owner of such a legendary place as if it was already a done deed.
Just what have we stumbled into?
The thief thought. At an unseen signal from Wright, or his seconds in command, the doors opened and two rows of drones marched into the room, each of them carrying a stack of papers. They set a stack in front of every representative and then headed back out again. One of them looked over its shoulder at Alfred and raised its tunic, mooning the Grand Master right before leaving. Alfred recognized the first page of the stack in front of him. It was a copy of Wright's terms and conditions. There was a small needle right next to the black line where the signature went. Carefully, The thief held the pin between his thumbs. The pirate's representative stood up, his gray whiskers trembling with indignation.
We knew this would happen. Your ambitions know no limit, Dungeon Lord. You intend to become a king, but you have no claim. Only the Pirate Queen is the true heir of the throne of Staravos, and she shall not abide by this.
Lord Wright gave no sign of noticing, or being worried about, the way the pirate's hand rested on his sword handle.
I'd like for your queen to be my ally in this fight. We all have the same enemy. Let's worry about royalty titles later. They're rather overvalued.
Will you have me killed after I leave this room?
The pirate asked.
Of course not. You're here in the city as my guest, Wright said.
As the pirate representative marched out, Chronicler Alder called after him.
The queen hasn't answered my sonnets, by the way. Would you mind telling her to check her letters once in a while?
The blonde sighed after the pirate was out of view.
Pirates, I swear. They've no manners. She'll come around, though. You'll see.
Alder,
Lavina whispered, elbowing him in the ribs.
Not now.
Only Alfred noticed the exchange, however, because the others were too busy commiserating with each other. The thief didn't need to listen in to know what they were talking about. The odds they had of profiting from accepting the pact, the risks, the pirate's importance for Undercity, Wright's own chances at surviving the endeavor. In short, boring stuff. Alfred had made his decision long before arriving at the tower. He made eye contact with the Dungeon Lord and with careful, deliberate motions, the thief pinched his thumb with the needle until a drop of blood came out. He pressed his thumb against the contract, leaving a red fingerprint above the black line. Then he slid the stack of papers toward Lord Wright.
They are quite reasonable conditions, Alfred said.
Wright grinned happily.
Ah, so you read them?
He asked. Alfred winced.
Well, there's a lot of pages, he said,
watching as Wright's grin lost its luster.
I did skim them, though. In any case, we are already pretty much de facto allies with the Haunt, so we may as well make it official.
And then he raised his voice to make sure the rest of the table would hear this part.
Also, the way I see it, we've really nothing to lose. If you manage to free Staravos, we're left in a much better spot than we're today. After all, we become a guild backed directly by our new ruler. On the other hand, if you get killed trying, then the pact is broken and we're back to square one.
Thank you for being so reasonable, Grand Master, Wright said.
After Alfred, the necromancer was next to accept the pact. It was a great show of faith because the necromancer's terms greatly limited the sources of the bodies they could harvest to create their undead.
I figure there'll be more than enough corpses to get around anyway,
was all the necromancer said as he handed over the papers. The Mercers, the Church of Oinus, and the Cult of the Many-Tentacled followed. Hours later, only the most respectable merchants and the nobility still had their doubts.
The pirate was right, you know,
Theodore told the Dungeon Lord.
A Dungeon Lord as king? The idea is preposterous. Your kind is famous for hiding underground, raiding villages, and sacrificing innocents to your demonic masters. There's no way the people of Staravos will ever accept you. And without a claim? Impossible.
Wright smiled, apparently impervious to Theodore's words.
Impossible? Like the captured hero the Haunt is studying right as we speak? Or impossible like expelling the Inquisition from a captured city and forcing their heroes to stay away from us? Because people said both of those things were impossible, and yet here we are.
Both achieved at a great cost of life, which, as I've heard, almost included yours,
Theodore said heatedly.
To unite Staravos, you'll need the support of the commoners and the noble-born. The small folk will fear you, and the nobility will never accept you. There's no precedent for a Dungeon Lord's ascension.
At this moment, all the candles in the room were snuffed, and a chill traveled across the backs of all present. Alfred had been around enough to know what this meant. The Dungeon Lord's pet vampire had arrived. Around him, people reached for their silver amulets and their divine symbols. Theodore drew an elegant dagger infused with blessed silver, Mist poured from a window and coalesced into the laughing shape of a girl of about 11 years of age. She'd grown since the last time Alfred had seen her, if such a feat was possible for the undead.
President!
Yarlin snarled, advancing slowly toward Theodore with elegant movements like those of a cat stalking her prey. A veil covered her face to spare Lord Wright's guest the sight of her dead features.
How adorable. I was alive when the men you call ancestors were crying for their mothers and soiling their diapers. That's your precedent, mortal. Those who came before me, though. Ah, they spoke of an age where what Lord Wraith proposes was the rule and not the exception. A time when the ancient lords stood as kings among vast lands and whose armies of minions brought ruin and devastation to their enemies as rivers of blood drowned entire cities!
The nightshade now turned to face the entire congregation, her voice rising in a terrible crescendo until it was as the wail of a banshee.
Have you heard the news the wind brings from distant places? The engines of war turn once more, and the ancient traditions are once again venerated. Forgotten evils stir in their tombs. The stars align across the vast night, and the portents speak of blood and fire. Yet you dare attend this portentous meeting and speak to me about precedent!
She turned suddenly and swatted Theodore's dagger away.
Tell me, mortal, when the army that doomed your father marches upon your country once again, who would you rather have fighting by your side when it's time to protect your woman and your children? The men and women who faltered and ran when the Inquisition came knocking?
She pointed at the people huddled behind Theodore.
Or would you rather have us, the meanest, cruelest, most abominable creatures, this side of the netherworld?
The shaking Theodore held the gaze of the vampire, and then he stumbled away. Yarlin hissed and walked past the congregation until she stood behind Lord Wraith. And in the end, despite the terror the vampire inspired in the living, most gazes fell on the dungeon lord himself. After all, he was the one who such creatures answered to, and Alfred found that, in the heavy darkness that had fallen upon the room, the only light visible was the otherworldly fire of the dungeon lord's eyes, giving his face the appearance of a ghostly skull, an image enhanced by the black skeletal hand that caressed his chin in a careless gesture.
Perhaps, thought Grandmaster Alfred, some rumors are indeed true.
Theodore stood, his mustache trembling with unbridled rage. He marched as to leave the room, then stopped halfway, balled his hands into fists, and went back to the stack of papers in front of his seat. Dungeon Lord Wright watched as, all across the table, others did the same. By the end of the night, Undercity was his.
Epilogue. Grand Master Gezvid slid like a shadow across the dusty corridors of the Akathunian safe house, his ears still ringing with the loss reports his men sent him all across the city. The slave dens had been raided by Kuftar and those spider and batblin abominations, hunting Akathunians like a princeling chases after game. If that wasn't enough humiliation, the vampire kept killing his warriors, and the netherworldly diviners blocked his guild's attempts at requesting help from the motherland. Now that he was away from the prying eyes of his men, always on the lookout for signs of weakness, he allowed himself to rest his back against a wall and massage his temples. Not long ago, the Assassin's Guild would have simply killed Lord Wright for the trouble he brought. But that had been before the hero's rampage through the charcoal tower that had culled Gezved's forces. It was as if the guild had suffered a terrible wound that night, and Wright's minions kept picking at the scab, forcing it to remain open and fester. The Akathunian was of the mind that Wright had orchestrated the whole thing. The attack on the charcoal tower, the heroic rampage, then Wright's convenient tower popping out in the Akathunian's headquarters. Even his sudden alliance with two heroes, if you believed the rumors, could be explained by an elaborate ruse that had been set up to destroy the Assassin's Guild in one fell swoop. But why? Had it been jealousy? Perhaps Lord Wright simply didn't like the competition. Perhaps he had some darker designs in mind. Whatever the answer, he had to be stopped. Gezved was not used to being hunted. Hiding like a common animal diminished him. His proud heritage demanded retribution. Something inside his study clanked. The old assassin clutched at the silver stake hanging by his neck, then relaxed his shoulders.
"Very well,"
he told the shadow sitting comfortably on the window sill between the fluttering drapes.
"Let us talk, Malikar."
The Lotian smiled.
"I'm glad you've finally seen reason, Grandmaster. Such a shame that it took the near-complete annihilation of your guild."
"You and your master," Gezved said wearily, feeling like he was forging a pact not unlike the one Wright offered his minions, albeit without any of the benefits. "What do you want from us?"
"At last,"
the Lotian exclaimed.
"The right question. Was that so hard?"
He raised his hands as he dropped down to the floor and strolled toward the Akathunian.
"Peace, Master Gezved. We want peace, and all we ask from you in exchange."
The Lotian caressed Gezved's cheek with one cold hand half closed, and the Akathunian saw the skin of the Lotian's face crawl as if a lurking creature stirred underneath.
"Is your complete obedience."
Gezved stepped away from the man, cold fear spreading through his limbs. The Lotian laughed and opened his hand to reveal a small, brown, worm-like creature wriggling on his palm. In some deep, dark chamber at the heart of the Citadel, three figures straight out of the Bardic Annals had one of their secret reunions. There were few among the Netherworld that possessed such knowledge of past, current, and future events as the three of them put together. They, who had once been active participants of history in the making, were now but lurking observers, watching from afar and waiting, perhaps, for the day when they might rise once again. Regent Corgoron, the Lady of Secrets, loved her little cabals. Today, though, she barely participated in the intrigues of the other two. Most of her attention belonged to the Shadow Tarot, whose cards were spread across the table in front of her with seemingly no rhyme nor reason. Her expression was troubled. Dungeon Lady Gulsa, on the other hand, was ever the merrier. Her mood always seemed to brighten when the Endeavor approached. It was as if the prospect of Dungeon Lord blood being spilled enticed her.
"Ah, my dear Regent, you oughtn't waste your time on daydreams. In truth, the tarot has spoiled you. It barely shows anything of notice lately. Only those boring black screens."
"Perhaps you're right, beloved,"
Corgoron said. Few would dare speak to the regent with such familiarity as Gulsa. Then again, none among Corgoron's mortals had lived in her domains as long as Gulsa had. In truth, she'd come to see the geriatric dungeon lady as a sort of pet, like those small dogs yipping as they ran around the skirts of mortal queens.
"Although Lord Everbleed is as distracted by my little pastime as I am."
The two turned to the gigantic mass of muscle, horns, and black armor that was the third member of their cabal. Tonight, Archlord Everbleed inhabited the body of the Hired Devil Knight, the faithful servant of the Archlords, a creature so powerful it could snap a minotaur in two with a flick of its wrist. Everbleed's real body wasn't as impressive, though. Many years ago, his minions had brought him to his dungeon seat, broken and barely clinging to life. There, his body had fused with the seat, casting aside mortal needs such as hunger or sleep,
and becoming a red jewel as eternal as the mountains, so long as no one destroyed it. Such a creature was called a dungeon jewel, and it was one of the paths to immortality that powerful dungeon lords could aspire to.
"Forgive me, Lady Golsa."
The knight spoke with a booming voice, his eyes shining with a mystical black fire.
"I am but an old man, with many fears and tribulations. If you will, distract me for a while."
With a single fingernail, he sifted through some tarot cards.
"Tell me, what do you think of this year's endeavors, attendance?"
Corgoron smiled. Everbleed had brought up Gulsa's favorite matter to get her to lay off their back. Now Gulsa could speak at her heart's desire, and they could try to make sense of the mess that the tarot showed. Corgoron had had her suspicions for a long time, as did Everbleed. None of them were good. Tonight, they'd be forced to voice them, a perspective that neither looked forward to.
"Most excellent, Lord Alaric,"
Gulsa said, clapping her hands.
"So many powerful contenders. It makes me hopeful for the future of the lordship. People from whom I hadn't heard in years are coming out of their hiding places to measure themselves against newly invested dungeon lords with luck and youthful passion on their side. Can you imagine the bloodbath? Ah, so exciting."
She gave a toothless grin.
"Lady Vaines will win, of course, but I wonder if the rumors are true, and the boatman will bring his own summoned dungeon lord to represent him."
Corgoron found one particularly worrisome card and handed it to Everbleed without a word. Like many cards, it showed that black screen so prevalent of late, but unlike most, this showed a possible future where the owner won. Everbleed met her gaze. The Devil Knight's visage lacked the facial flexibility to display most emotions that weren't murderous anger or angry murderousness, but Corgoron knew the Archlord well enough to realize he was as worried as she.
"Baseless rumors,"
the regent told Gulsa distractedly.
"My brother has no business in the Netherworld. His role is to serve Murmur's will across the plains."
Besides, the only summoned dungeon lord that Corgoron knew about was right, and he was hers.
"Maybe,"
Gulsa said.
"Maybe not. In any case, that dreadful berserker shall be a huge annoyance. But Vaines has more combat experience than anyone else. She takes the win. That's my prediction."
"What about one of those young lords?"
asked Everbleed.
"Maybe the one whose towers are giving the Heligians such trouble. Everyone in the Citadel is talking about that."
Gulsa waved dismissively.
"It was bound to happen that someone would come up with a way to counter the heroes. The Wraith lacks the expertise, the allies, and the power to hold on to his invention. Someone else shall come soon and take it from him. Or the Inquisition will figure out a way to bypass the towers, and then they'll break him."
"If I didn't know you so well, beloved, I'd think you were a bit jealous that some young upstart won where you failed,"
Corgoron pointed out.
"Bah!"
Gulsa shook her head.
"Not at all. Each generation has its own challenges to overcome. I won mine, dear regent. The first iteration of heroes was broken by my hands, and as long as my rule lasted, it was great. My time passed, as is the way of mortals. The new heroes are someone else's challenge, and that's all right with me,"
she said in a tone that indicated she wasn't entirely all right. Corgoron had to smile. Sometimes, Gulsa could be more than she let on.
"You know,"
Gulsa went on,
"I once had such a strange dream. In it, a man from another world had built the heroes himself, instead of the Inquisition randomly coming up with them like it happened in the real world. This summoned hero and I were terrible enemies, and we faced each other in uncountable battles, his creations against my minions. And in this lethal rivalry, we were both extolled by the other's hatred. Facing him, in my dream, I was forced to be my best self, terrible and brilliant as I've never been before or since. And there was this unspoken understanding between the two of us, that when the day of our final confrontation came, we'd be joined, in a way, when the loser's experience points were absorbed by the winner, and then our opposed ideals would finally find a common ground.
The old woman bit her lip and shook her head, prey of a sudden, deep nostalgia.
But that fated confrontation never came. The man vanished before the dream was over. It was as if, since then, I am but a shadow of what I could have been. Not long after having that dream, the new iteration of heroes replaced the old, and the rest is history. Sounds silly, doesn't it? It was only just a fantasy.
Gulsa trailed off, her gaze distant. For some unfathomable reason, she was crying. Maybe she had finally gone senile. The Lady of Secrets turned to the Dungeon Lady. The silly daydreams of the old crone had gotten the demon's attention.
A man only remembered in a dream.
When objectivity erased a person from history, it wasn't a complete erasure. Otherwise, no one would know it had happened at all in the first place. One of the places where objectivity's interference could be revealed was in the Shadow Tarot. Another was in the dreams of those closest to the erased. And none were as close to a man of destiny as its forsworn enemy.
Could it be?
Gorgoron,
Everbleed called, breaking her out of her revelry. The Lady of Secrets dismissed her train of thought as a silly idea. Why, Gulsa the Gossip, this old pet of hers, a summoned hero's nemesis? The idea was contemptible. Sometimes dreams were only dreams.
Can the Shadow Tarot show the possible futures of a dead man?
For an instant, Gorgoron thought Everbleed meant the person in Gulsa's dream. Then she realized he was handing out the card back to her.
Never,
she said.
The dead have no future.
And yet the owner of that card has been dead for decades,
Everbleed said quietly. Like that, Everbleed and Gorgoron faced the truth neither wanted to confront.
What does that tell us?
She asked the Archlord.
Wait a second,
said Gulsa, blinking and becoming good old Gossip Gulsa again.
A dead man's future? Who are you talking about?
Both ignored her.
I did not want to believe it,
Everbleed admitted.
But it's harder every day to keep ignoring the facts. My men have found evidence. Nothing more than suspicions and conjectures, really, of a hidden hand guiding mortal affairs toward chaos and war to an unknown purpose, something that goes beyond the means of a normal dungeon lord. In fact, it's said that dungeon lords are being as manipulated as kings and generals alike.
I have found the same,
Gorgoron told him.
It has his mark all over it.
Gorgoron gazed at the black expanse displayed in the card. For an instant, she'd thought the darkness had crawled, as if the black screen wasn't a malfunction of the tarot at all, but a real possible future where the world was consumed by untold millions of crawling, hungering creatures bloating the sky, devouring all life. A heavy silence fell across the chamber. Gorgoron thought it fitting. If it was the time for the old traditions to return, it was also the time for the ancient monsters to walk the earth once more.
It's time to consider the nightmare scenario. That he fooled us since the beginning,
Everbleed said.
That somehow, somewhere, Dungeon Lord Sephar is alive.
Edward Wright. Species, human. Total experience, 750. Unused experience, 245. Claims, lordship, Undercity's ruler. Attributes, brawn, 13. Agility, 11. Endurance, 14. Mind, 13. Spirit, 16. Plus 1 Dungeon Lord Mantle, equals 17. Charm, 13. Plus 1 Dungeon Lord Mantle, equals 14. Skills. Athletics, basic, 9. The owner has trained his body to perform continuous physical activity without penalties to their endurance. For a while. Basic rank allows them to realize mild energy-consuming tasks, non-combat, such as running or swimming without tiring. Unlocks stamina-related talents. Melee. Basic. 9. Measures the user's progress in physical combat. It opens up melee-related talents as well as advanced martial skill specializations. Dungeon Engineering. Improved. 9. This skill represents the user's knowledge of magical constructs pertaining to dungeon craft. As it improves, it opens new rooms and traps, as well as adds to the Dungeon Lord Mantle capacity of storing the user's own blueprints. Combat Casting. Basic. 8. Pertains to the speed and efficiency of spells cast during combat or life-threatening situations. Basic status allows the caster to use spells every 20 seconds. 1 second per extra rank. The caster must say their names aloud and perform the appropriate hand gestures. Leadership. Improved. 6. Reflects the owner's capacity of inspiring and managing his troops and minions. For a dungeon lord, improving this skill adds to the bonus he and his minions receive. Talents. Evil Eye. Allows the dungeon lord to see the objectivity of any creature or item. If the target of his gaze possesses a strong spirit, or related attribute or skill, they may hide their information if the lord's own spirit is not strong enough. Veil-piercing evil eye. The dungeon lord's evil eye is upgraded with a constant effect. The evil eye can now detect invisibility and similar forms of concealment, and has an advantage at piercing illusions and magical misdirection. Veil-piercing cannot affect legendary-ranked magic or higher. Energy drain? Active. Very low. Dungeon Lord Mantle. The mantle is the heart of the Dungeon Lord and represents the Dark Pact made in exchange for power. It allows the Dungeon Lord access to the Dungeon Lord's status and powers as defined by the dungeon screen. It allows the Dungeon Lord to create and control dungeons as per the limitations of his dungeon screen. Energy drain? None. Improved reflexes. Allows the owner to experience increased reaction time for a small burst of time. Basic status elevates his reaction speed to a degree dictated by the owner's agility for a duration of 3 seconds per use. Improved metabolism. Reduces the energy costs of all talents by 25%. The caloric requirements of the user are increased by the same amount. Energy drain? Activated. High. Resist sickness. Basic. Allows its owner to resist disease and sickness. Basic status allows the owner to resist non-magical sickness as if they had endurance of 15 and were in optimal conditions. Clean, well-fed, rested. Spellcasting. Basic. 4. Domains. General. Forbidden. Healing. Represents the owner's magical ability. Basic status allows the caster to use and learn all basic related spells of their domain. Extra ranks improve each individual spell's characteristics, such as range or damage. Efficient status grants the owner 1 extra basic spell. Allowed spells. 1 basic per day plus 1 basic spell due to dungeon lordship. Energy drain. Active. Varies per spell. Ancient Lord Aura. The owner creates an aura around him that enhances allied beings inside its area of effect. Affected beings can use the Dungeon Lord's spirit as their own while this aura is active. Their physical attributes are also bolstered plus 1 while this aura is active. If the creature is a minion of the Dungeon Lord, they are immune to fear while affected by this aura. Duration, 1 minute. Energy drain, activated. Moderate. Pledge of Armor. Any armor that the Dungeon Lord wears is considered magical, as if it had a minor protection enchantment. This bonus stacks with any protection enchantment the armor may have, or any other similar defensive enchantment. Magical armor can deflect spells of similar power category, as well as normal weaponry. Restriction: selecting this talent locks out the Pledge of Bloodshed advancement option. Pledge of Muted Armor. The Dungeon Lord's Pledge of Armor is upgraded with new effects. Upon falling unconscious or being otherwise impaired, a team of 4 rescue drones is generated around his person. The rescue drones will stop at nothing to drag the Dungeon Lord to the nearest safe place, but they lack defensive capabilities. In addition, the Dungeon Lord can hide his armor's magical output at no extra energy cost. Energy drain, passive. Spell list. Minor order. Command. The caster forces a target creature to follow a simple order as long as said order is not immediately against the creature's moral code or presents a threat to its life. Eldritch Edge. Enchantment. The caster adds a magical flame to the edge of a weapon. This flame makes the weapon magical for the duration, allowing it to bypass weak magical defenses and mundane ones. Duration, 1 minute per spellcraft rank. Murmur's Reach. Command, Mantle. The caster possesses a minion located in the same dungeon as the caster. The caster's body is left defenseless during this time. Duration, 10 minutes per spellcraft rank. Dungeon's Message. Divination. This spell allows you to send a 140-character message to any minion of the caster located anywhere on the same plane as the casting Dungeon Lord. The message is sent through the link between minion and Dungeon Lord, and as such, cannot be replicated by others. Warning: this does not stop a minion with a very low mind score from being tricked by non-magical means. Stone Pillar. The Dungeon Lord targets an area of solid ground with a 5-foot radius, which, after 3 seconds, bursts upward in the shape of a stone column, rising to 20 feet or until it reaches a ceiling. This effect is limited by the availability of material in the chosen area and cannot be used to create matter out of nothing. If the Dungeon Lord has an improved combat casting above 5, the channeling time is reduced to 2 seconds. This has been Dungeon Lord, Abominable Creatures, The Wraith's Haunt, Book 3. Written by Hugo Huesca. Narrated by Jeff Hayes. Featuring Annie Ellicott as Lavina Odessa Treville, Kessa of Green, and the rest of the female cast. Editing and Proofing by Dalton Lynn. Editing, Mastering, and Sound Design by Griffin Malnar. Additional Sound Design by Jeff Hayes. Copyright 2018 by Hugo Huesca. Production Copyright 2018 by Hugo Huesca. A Sound Booth Theater production. To stay up to date on our productions or to see us perform live, sign up for our newsletter at soundbooththeater.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.